Hey, this is Josh Kaufman. I just wanted to begin here by saying a quick thanks for checking out this first episode of my new podcast, The Pair. And if you enjoy it, please subscribe, share it with friends, and consider checking out my Patreon page. If by chance you aren't familiar with Patreon, it's a unique way to support and be involved with and connect with creators who make things that you like. There will be a link in the notes of the podcast, and you can find information as well on my social media pages and my website. I'd love for you to give it a look. That said, without any further ado, here is The Pair. So I have spent roughly half a lifetime trying to decide whether to be an artist or an academic, a creator or a thinker, a musician or a philosopher. And it seems that every time I try to wholeheartedly choose one side, I end up longingly missing the other. And so I find myself here hoping that perhaps I've finally found the thing that creates that necessary balance. And that thing is this thing that you're listening to, this podcast, The Pair. In each episode, I will explore some curiosity, some big question, an issue, a dilemma, or something. And I'll go as far as reason will take me, but then I'll try to go a bit further. You see, each episode, or possibly a group of episodes, will act as the inspiration for a piece of music, or maybe some other artistic endeavor, maybe a collaboration, or another artist's work altogether. I don't know. I just know I want to push reason and words to their limits, and explore that line where reason comes to an end, where words fail, which is why I chose to start here.
It's their language. We need to make sure that they understand the difference between a weapon and a tool. Language is messy, and sometimes one can be both.
If that rings no bells, it is a piece of the trailer for the 2016 sci-fi film Arrival, in which Amy Adams plays the character Louise Banks, a linguist who is brought in by the U.S. military to translate the language of and attempt to communicate with aliens who have arrived here on Earth. And in doing so, she finds that having knowledge of this language somehow opens up her mind to completely new ways of thinking and seeing the world. Now, I really liked this movie, and I remember being immediately and especially intrigued by the main idea around which the film's story is built, namely this idea that language shapes thought. Well, there was something kind of beautiful about that. And clearly there are a lot of different reasons someone might find this idea interesting. Language is often viewed as a significant part of a person's identity and culture, and there might be something appealing about the idea that maybe my language gives me a unique view of the world as compared to someone who speaks another language. Or someone might be drawn to the idea that, hey, if I learn another language, I'm potentially opening up whole new ways of seeing and understanding. But for me, the intrigue and interest was about limits. If thought is determined by language, well, another way of saying that is that thought is limited by language. What we are capable of thinking is bound by what we are capable of saying. And that would be a rather significant fact, if in fact it turned out to be a fact. Anyway, as is the case with so much science fiction, there is some actual science upon which the fiction of the movie Arrival is built. Turns out that in the field of linguistics, there's been a good deal of research, speculation, and experimentation built around the idea that language determines thought.
I'm recording.
All right, perfect. If you could just say who you are, what you do?
Yeah, I'm Ann Bunger. I'm a senior lecturer in linguistics at Indiana University.
Perfect.
Yeah, is that enough?
Yeah, that's great. Let's see. So where do we want to...
Ann Bunger specializes in, among other things, psycholinguistics and language and cognition. So I thought she might be able to shed a little light on this topic. Naturally, I had to begin our discussion at the place where this whole line of inquiry started for me, the movie Arrival.
My favorite piece of it is that she's using rulers, which is every linguist's favorite tool. Completely unrelated to language. They did, her office is like almost detail for detail, book for book, a copy of a Canadian linguist's office. Like they went to this person's office and set up cameras.
Oh, really?
And then bought all of the books that were in her office and used them in the movie. And yeah,
so
at least that part of it is accurate. But yeah, so that movie is looking at the idea of linguistic relativity, or even to take it further, linguistic determinism.
These two theories, linguistic determinism and its softer variant, linguistic relativity, are at the heart of what we're talking about here. And as far as I can tell, nearly any in-depth discussion of these theories from the last century begins with a guy named Benjamin Lee...
Whorf. That's where my understanding of it starts. So Whorf was a...
Whorf was born in Massachusetts in 1897 and developed an interest in language at an early age. His undergraduate study was not, however, in language, or even a related field for that matter. He went to MIT and studied chemical engineering, after which he became...
a professional fire inspector.
A fire inspector. Probably not what you'd expect from a guy who's known for his work in linguistics, but even as a fire inspector, Whorf was always thinking about language.
I think there's an interesting thing I might be able to tell you about gas cans being empty that's worth me looking up. So, related courses. Okay, so back to this idea. So Whorf was interested in following up on some ideas that he had about the relationship between language and thought while he was working as an insurance adjuster. One of the things he observed has to do with gasoline drums that he would see that were labeled empty, because there was like no trash in them or anything. And so people on job sites would be throwing lit cigarettes into them because they were empty gasoline drums, and then the whole thing would catch on fire. And, you know, so he had this idea that, you know, that word empty was creating a limit in their mind to understanding that there might actually be something.
So in spite of his early career path, Whorf just couldn't let go of his interest in language. And he continued to actively pursue that interest during his time as a fire inspector. He became particularly interested in Mesoamerican languages like Mayan and Aztec. He did research in his spare time at the Harvard Library, consulted and connected with experts on the topic, wrote about his thoughts and conclusions, and ultimately applied for and received a grant which he used to fund field research of native dialects in Mexico. Upon returning, that work that he did in Mexico was very well received, and finally, in his early 30s, Benjamin Lee Whorf began officially studying linguistics at Yale as a non-degree graduate student.
He was also an amateur scholar of Native American languages. And so when he was in grad school, the work that he did was with Hopi, the language Hopi, and their conceptions of time. And his study of this, the grammar of Hopi, led him to conclude that Hopi must be thinking differently about time because their grammars are different from ours. Basically, I think he thought that their perceptions of times were cyclical, and so they couldn't understand past and future the way that we did. It was all one moment in time.
This work on the Hopi conception of time is Worf's most well-known, most quoted, most analyzed work. It's his big contribution to the field of linguistics, and it really gets right to the heart of this idea that we began with. The idea that is the inspiration behind a fictional character acquiring an entirely new way of seeing the world as the result of learning an alien language. The idea that our language affects and limits how and what we can think. This amateur linguist, who started as a fire inspector, had made his mark. Only.
So, like, his data has been debunked. He never talked to any Hopi speakers.
Oh, wow.
He just based this on his own ideas about, like, writings about Hopi or just, like, looking at dictionaries of the language or grammars of the language.
And that's kind of where his legacy stands. Benjamin Lee Worf began his graduate studies in 1930. Just over a decade later, in 1941, he died an untimely death. He was only 44 years old. And by the 1950s, he'd become something of an academic punching bag.
So, people, you know, pulled ideas out from what Worf and his advisor Sapir were saying and came up with this theory that they associate with them called linguistic determinism, which is the idea that the language that you learn and the categories that exist in that language determine the way that you can think, because the world is chaos and, you know, we have to have some way to organize it, and language is what humans settled on to help us organize our experiences. No one really believes in that extreme view anymore, and there's a softer view called linguistic relativity.
Now, Worf's linguistic relativity has had its supporters and defenders over the years.
It has heydays and then lulls and then heydays again. We're sort of at the end of a heyday of that, maybe.
And there have been experiments, the results of which do seem to appear to confirm that, yes, one's language does, in fact, significantly affect how one is capable of thinking. For instance, in Russian, there are separate color words for light blue and dark blue, whereas English simply uses the word blue for both, with a modifier, light or dark. And in one experiment, comparing Russian speakers to English speakers, the Russian speakers were, on average, able to more quickly discriminate differences between light blue and dark blue. Just what you'd expect if linguistic relativity is true, right?
What happens in most of those experiments is whoever said, hey, this works, never really did a non-linguistic task.
And that's important, because if the language you speak truly affects your thinking on a fundamental level, then those effects should be observable even when you're performing a mental task in which language is not involved. But what tended to happen in these experiments is that
they either gave them instructions that were ambiguous for the conceptual task, and so they had to use language to figure out what they were supposed to do, or they gave them like a memory task, and the way that humans remember things is often just to recite them, right? So if they gave them a task in which they were supposed to remember like a sequence of colors, and then reconstruct that set of colors a minute later, like, they're going to remember that sequence of colors by labeling them, reciting the words in their head, and then doing it. And so what seems like a non-linguistic task becomes a linguistic task, because people will covertly use language to help them do things.
And so it turns out that when you do effectively remove language from the equation, the apparent difference nearly, or often completely, disappears. In the Russian versus English experiment, for example, when participants were asked to perform an unrelated verbal task at the same time that they were doing the color identification task so that they couldn't access language to discriminate the colors, the differences between the Russian speakers and the English speakers went away. And this seems to be the case for the most part across the board. A person's native language does seem to have some effect on how cognitive processes occur, but it appears that removal of the linguistic element of the cognitive process nearly always eliminates or at least drastically reduces the effect of language. In other words, in most cases, language is at most a cognitive tool. It doesn't affect thinking at a basic, fundamental level, as Worf believed it did. Now, I'm being careful here to say in most cases. From what I read while researching this topic, it does look like there may be rare instances in which language is fundamental to a certain kind of thinking. One such example seems to be numerosity. It looks as if language is very important in being able to think about larger numbers. And perhaps, maybe probably, there are other exceptions too, but the notable thing is that they are just that, exceptions. So what then can we say about Benjamin Lee Worf's legacy? Because it does appear that on the whole, he was wrong. Language doesn't play the role that he suggested it played. However, he did start a conversation that's been going on for the better part of a century. And that's no small accomplishment. Whether his conclusions were right or wrong, he moved us down a path of inquiry, and we know more now for having gone down that path. And where does that knowledge leave us? It seems that if our thought is limited by the language that we speak, it is only to a minimal degree. And as appealing as linguistic relativity might be, the current best science seems to suggest that at most, a very limited version of it is true. Thought is not bound by language. As I suggested at the outset, there are a number of reasons why we might be drawn to this idea of language shaping thought. And so seeing that it doesn't may come as a disappointment. But we would do well to keep in mind the potential negatives that come along with believing in linguistic determinism or some stronger form of linguistic relativity. It's not too much of a stretch to imagine this belief fairly easily lending itself to a kind of linguistic ethnocentrism or sense of superiority. You can't comprehend this, you know, because you don't speak my language, something like that. It is much better and more accurate, for that matter, to see language as something that binds us rather than something that separates us. As noted linguist John McWhorter says in his book, The Language Hoax, quote, "If you want to learn about how humans differ, study cultures. However, if you want insight as to what makes all humans worldwide the same, beyond genetics, there are few better places to start than how language works," unquote. Perhaps if an alien race truly did visit us from the far reaches of space, we wouldn't find that learning their language opened up a whole new way of seeing the world. Maybe we'd find that they see it and talk about it a lot like us. Still, even after all this, I find myself wondering about limits. Where does the utility of language end? Where does the capacity for thinking and reason end? And what do we do when we reach those ends? Be sure to check out the next episode of The Pair as I continue to explore the limits of language through the life and work of one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century.